Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Fighter's Voice with Don McGuire, presented by Finished MMA and the United Way Merced.
I'm your host, Don McGuire, being joined by my mutual host, Mr. Barry Frost. You know, tonight is a tremendous show. We like doing these legends in boxing because it brings back the days that when I was a young man, you know, we used to look forward to Wide World of Sports Sundays with Howard Cosell, and you used to get home and everybody pile around the television set and you get to watch a tremendous night of the Sweet Science. You know, those days are long gone, so we felt it was a necessity to reach back and bring some of these legends back to you and let them tell their stories the way they should be told from them, not on social media, not on television, but directly from the fighter themselves. You know, Barry, we got a hell of a champion on the show tonight, brother.
Yeah, no doubt. Mr. Eddie Mustafa Muhammad's joining us tonight.
Yeah, you know, I'm so looking forward to that. And with that being said, why don't we just go ahead and bring the champ on, because I'm intrigued to hear the stories that he's got to tell. So with that being said, welcome, Eddie Mustafa Muhammad. Eddie, how's it going, sir?
It's going great. You know, I'm just in the gym every day, you know, doing a lot of positive things and just keep moving.
Oh, you got to. You know, I'm in my 50s, and it's like, I'll be in three different states in a day and a half. So, you know, people go, how do you do it? I said, well, man, if I stop, I'll die.
you don't want to stop. That's right.
No,
you don't want to stop.
That's what it catches you. You know, I want to start back. You know, this show is a little bit different. It's uniquely different than probably any other show you've ever done. We'll talk about all different aspects of your life, career, and take different thoughts and different paths. But, you know, I kind of want to jump to 1975, you know, the night you faced Benny Briscoe. To me, I watched some of that today, and to me, that was truly a fight that I feel that you defined yourself as a warrior. You found your stride in the ring, and that you truly, from that point forward, realized that you were going to be a world champion. Would you say that's a fair analogy?
That's a fair analogy, because I knew the type of fighter Benny was, and at his age, you know, he couldn't change. He had one style that was coming forward, and I like guys to come forward with me, because I can just step around and drop some bombs on him and keep on stepping around, let him try to find me, but I was always right in front of him.
Are you there, or did we lose you?
I'm right here.
Oh, okay. I apologize about that. You know, yeah, like I said, I watched that fight, and, you know, it's tremendous, because from that day forward, you know, a lot of people call you guys warriors, but from that day forward, I looked at you as a gladiator. You know, what you brought to the Sweet Science was second to none. What was the original aspect of it? Because you were tremendous in the Golden Gloves as a young man. You know, and on the show, I guess the best way to say it stymies me sometimes, because some of you legends in boxing hold fonder memories of the Golden Gloves more than you do your professional career. What is it about the Golden Gloves that truly established you as a young man in life?
First and foremost, it's a prestigious tournament, very prestigious. When you got Ray Robinson that won the New York Golden Gloves, you got a guy who I've beaten, Vito Antifermo. He won the Golden Gloves, and all of them became world champions. I had a great time at the Golden Gloves. I had, you know, I mean, it was like, I remember as if it was yesterday when I won my second Golden Gloves title.
Well, you won them back to back, 71 and 72. 71, you beat Antetokounmpo, and I think you stunned the world, man, back in those days. You know, your career is one that has been a tremendous one. You know, I look back, we were talking about James Toney before we went live. We've had Livingstone Bramble, we've had, you know, Ray Mercer. I mean, the list goes on and on. And I truly always wanted you on the show, so when you hit me last Saturday night and I was shooting a fight, I felt so bad when you said, give me a call, and I couldn't because I was shooting a fight. But
right.
this was an opportunity I've been dying to have. So, and I know Barry has too. Barry's a walking book on, I guess an encyclopedia on boxing. So I'm going to pass it over to him, let him ask you a couple more questions, and then I'll get back with you. Barry?
Hey, Eddie, how are you tonight, sir?
Barry, I'm fine. Everything is great. I'm having a great time doing what I love to do, and that's making world champions.
Absolutely. I like to start kind of from the beginning and go through, you know, to the end. So I'm going to take you back to the, you know, the Howard House's gym there in Brownsville.
Oh, man, that's way back. That's way back.
with Al Fischetti. And kind of take us into how you ended up there and some of the guys you ran with and, basically the neighborhood. Take us back to that time.
Well, basically, it was a great, great group of guys that I've had the pleasure to train with when I was the amateur. You know, we had Ron Oliver, two-time Golden Glove champion. We had Al Mitchell, two-time Golden Glove champion. Gaylord Bryant, Charlie Hunter, a three-time Golden Glove champion. We won the team trophy every year. You know, I treasure those memories. It was like, you know, I look forward to going down to the gym. Thomas Chestnut, he was another two-time Golden Glove champion. Every year, we won the team title.
Yeah, and that kind of goes with the old adage that, you know, iron sharpens iron. You know, you guys were, you know, basically fighting each other and getting you guys basically ready for other teams that were coming in to face you guys in box-offs.
Exactly, exactly. And I want to give to our coach, Al Fischetti. You know, he taught us more than just boxing. Al Fischetti taught us how to be a man, how to adapt and adjust to situations. And you got to remember, back in those days, Al was an Italian man. You know, he would come to the gym at 5 o'clock, and he would leave like about 9 o'clock at night. He lived in Staten Island, and he would have to walk to the train station. But he was so respected in the Brownsville neighborhood. He was the only white guy that I know that can walk 10 o'clock at night to the train station. And the train station was about a mile down the road. But everybody knew him. That's how much respect he garnered, you know, from guys out in Brownsville, even the winos.
Yeah. Now, there was a story of a young man who was, a pretty talented boxer that hung around the gym there for a little while. And he... what was it? He like would rob places with a mink coat on or something?
And no, he robbed. Let's be serious. He didn't. He robbed banks. That's the problem. His name was Shuby Streets. He was a good.
Yes,
as
yeah.
a matter of fact, he was a Golden Glove champion.
Yeah,
Golden Glove champion. So one day Al brought the newspaper, the New York Daily News, to the gym, and on the front page, they called him the Fur Coat Bandit. He's leaping over tables and chairs and robbing the bank. And Al brought it to the gym, the paper. We knew who it was. But, you know, listen, we're not going to squeal on nobody because he was one of us. You know, as long as he didn't hurt the team, he can do what he wanted to do. You know, we never squealed on him, never told on him. He always would bring tons of money to the gym and pass it out. So how could
and,
you
and
really
he,
tell a guy
he didn't
like that?
He didn't hide either. He wore
no,
that
everybody knew who he was. Exactly. We knew who he was. He was one of us.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line. He was one of us.
Now, let me take you to, 1969, where you, you enter the Golden Gloves. Was this your first, Golden Gloves, first time entering, right? Was in 69.
Exactly. Right.
And you knocked out Tom Sissinger in your first fight.
Exactly.
And then, you lost your next one. And
right.
So the next year, you've had that experience. It's 1970. You're basically working at a department store stocking shelves.
Big Mays department store.
See, I'm on it, Eddie.
You're definitely on it. You're definitely on it.
After having that first initial experience, were the nerves gone or were you always nervous heading into the Golden Gloves?
Well, you know what it was? I got sick. I had to withdraw from the Golden Gloves. I had got sick. It's something I ate. I had got sick, and I had to withdraw. But I told myself that I was going to win it the next year.
And that year in 70, Harold Weston ended up winning that 147-pound, the open division.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
He ended
what
up
a boxer
being,
he was.
And he ended up being the future matchmaker for Madison Square Garden.
Being to this day, Hal and I are good friends.
And Vito Antifermo, he won the sub novice division that same year.
Exactly.
So that sets up. I think you kind of renewed your hunger, and in 71, it was you and Vito were both. You basically steamrolled the competition and set up the finals between
right.
You two in front of a sold-out Madison Square Garden, almost 20,000 people. Take us to that night where you're walking out in front of 20,000 people to fight Vito.
Well, first and foremost, it was beautiful. The air was clean. Air conditioning was blowing beautifully. The lights were, dim. When we came out, they put the spotlight on us. I mean, it was a great experience. And I said, all I got to do is keep on winning, and I'll be getting these types of experiences all the time. And I knew how Vito fought. He didn't change his style. He couldn't change it because this was the finals, the Golden Gloves. He
right.
had his crowd. I had my crowd. And, like I said, I love to fight guys that come to me. I can box your ears off. And that's exactly what I did. Vito put the pressure on me. I just boxed him.
Yeah. And you, I believe to this day, I think you and Vito are the only two future world champions to ever fight in the Golden Glove Finals.
Exactly.
I believe that still stands.
It still
and
stands
I'll,
to this day.
And I'll let Don jump back in here, and then I'll come back to you, man. We'll pick up.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I love that aspect that you brought that up, Barry, because think of how many world champions in boxing that we've had on the show. And, Eddie, a lot of them would say, when I got the opportunity to fight in the Phelps Forum, I was waiting for my day to fight in Madison Square Garden. And here you had that opportunity before you ever became pro. So, kind of just leading off of what Barry said, how did it feel to get that opportunity that a lot of champions and legends in the day didn't even get until later on in their career?
First and foremost, it was a great feeling. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. That's my hometown. And to fight in the Garden where all your friends can come and see you fight, that was a great experience for me. Right then and there, I had my taste of becoming a champion in the amateur ranks.
You really did. Barry, I can't remember, it was the Harlem Butcher that we had on the show, and he had talked about how much those Golden Glove, his Golden Glove necklace meant to, you know, to have around his neck, and that that was one of his most cherishable memories in his collection. Would you say that that's the same for you, Eddie?
Yes, to this day. And let me tell you, it is one of the most cherished possessions that I've ever won. Forget about the world championships that I won. Being a New York Golden Gloves champion, you know, put that gold chain around your neck, and I got two of them. But unfortunately, I lent them to a friend. I thought he was a friend, and he's still running with those chains around his neck. So I'm going to see if I can get a pair made, and I'll be content.
Yeah, we might be able to make that happen. You know, we do a lot in correlation with Ring 10 and Ring 8, and Matt Fargo out there. They actually just had a – who was it that they did that for, Barry, that they had lost their Golden Gloves necklace and they had a replica made?
They did it for Howard Davis, Jr., who sadly passed away.
Yeah, Howard was a good guy. But, you know, the thing about my Golden Gloves, this guy, I thought he was a friend. And, you know, we used to go out and eat together. So he asked me, he said, I'm going to take my wife out to dinner. Can I borrow your Golden Gloves? And I gave him both pairs, you know, one for his wife to wear and, you know, one for him to wear. And I never saw him right after that.
Yeah, you know, sadly that's how life is in a lot of aspects. But, you know, that brings up a good point. You know, we had Tony the Tiger Lopez on, and, you know, I've known him for a lot of years, and when we were younger, there was a young kid that used to hang around us by the name of, I can't even remember his name right now on my own show, and he's my favorite. You know what I'm talking about, Barry? Diego.
Diego Corrales.
Corrales?
Yeah.
What a guy.
You know,
what a guy.
He was the little runt that hung around us back in the day. And he wasn't even in the sport yet. You know, he used to hang around the gym because I used to, in Sacramento there, I used to be with Pete Ranzani, Loretta Garza,
right,
and Tony the Tiger, right, Lopez. And Diego started showing up, and he always wanted to box. What was it about the sport that enthralled you, Eddie, to step up into this aspect of life?
Well, my thing was, I was a one-on-one guy. I didn't need a team of guys to protect me like when you play football, baseball, basketball. It was boxing is one-on-one, mano a mano, and that's the way I liked it. I wanted to show them my skills, my tenacity, and my toughness.
Yeah, and I believe you truly did. You know, I kind of want to jump to a different aspect out of the cage because I know Barry's going to jump into the ring in a second here. But, you know, a lot of people don't realize that you had a role in Raging Bull. What was that aspect like for you, Eddie, jumping up on the screen?
Well, you know, I never had aspects to become a movie star. But when you got Robert De Niro coming to ask you, would you be in a movie? You know, I knew a lot about Robert De Niro before he became a huge superstar. And I knew he was going to be a huge superstar. And so we went to the gym. We worked out. He liked what he seen. He asked me, would I be in a movie? I said, yes, I would. And if I'm not mistaken, we won Oscars for that movie. I think we won about maybe like 5 Oscars for that movie.
Yes, you did. You know, I watched a fight earlier today. I was telling Barry before we went live, and we were kind of talking about it. And I look at it, and I look at it, and I look at it, and I wanted to get your opinion on it because, honestly, in my heart, I think you were robbed that night. And it was for the WBA World Light Heavyweight title against Michael Spinks back in 1981. It went to a unanimous decision. I don't know, man. You know, I watched it. And I'm a firm believer that you won that fight. What are the thoughts of Eddie Mustafa Muhammad now that you sit back and you look at that fight, do you feel that that fight was truly yours?
Well, going in the fight, I had problems making a weight because I sprained my back. So I was in the hospital for like about a week. You know, they were trying to straighten my back situation out. And I didn't want to pull out of the fight because I know I can beat Michael. You know, so on with the fight. And I said to myself, and like I said, I had problems making the weight. I made the weight. And I just told myself, going into the fight, he is not going to beat me. And I willed myself. And we went 15 rounds. And you have to remember, you have to weigh in the day of the fight. So I'm in the steam room right up until the last 5 minutes of the fight. I made the weight, but it was crazy hard. But like I told myself, this man, first and foremost, we're going 15 rounds. We're going 15 rounds. He's not going to stop me. I'm going to beat him. You know, I thought I'd beat him.
You know, see, I think you do. I think you did, too. And one thing that kind of is a complacency with me in the sport today, you know, I don't really think that there's a true heavyweight champion. I don't think there's a true leader in the sweet science today. I think the grit and grime aspect of what you guys brought to the sport is truly gone. What do you think it's going to take for the sport to get back where it used to be, or do you think it's an afterthought?
Well, see, I really think it's an afterthought because everybody wanna dress up and wear fancy this and fancy that, and after you fight 10 fights, you fight for world championships. We had to earn our right to fight for a world championship. You know, I've had 60 pro fights. You know, I earned my way to fight for the title. You know, I would have won it after I fought Victor Galindez. You know, it was just crazy. But look, I just take it with a grain of salt. You know, I became world champion. I fulfilled my goals and defended the title a few times, and that was it.
Yeah. Well, you created quite a legacy, my friend. You truly are the reason why I think a lot of us, you know, I'm in my 50s, and I think you're one of the real reasons why a lot of us love the sport we do. I'm going to ask you one more question before I pass it to Barry. You know, I got an opportunity late back in 96 as I got my career started in shooting and boxing. But I had an opportunity to meet the great Muhammad Ali. What was that relationship like with you and Muhammad?
We had more of a brother relationship. Everywhere Muhammad went, he always asked me to come along with him. You know, he would come and get me when I was living in Brooklyn. Come and get me. Meet me outside. I'm down the block in a car. You know, things like that. I mean, Muhammad is solely responsible for me winning the world title. Because if it wasn't for Muhammad, I don't think I would have ever won a world title. He gave his training camp to me on a full basis. So I was there for like 3 months in the camp training. Nothing but serious training. I've boxed Muhammad over 100 rounds. We boxed so many times. At one point, he pulled the plug out of the wall. Said, we don't need no bell. Let's just fight till we fall out. That's the type of guy he was. He wanted me to win that world championship real bad.
You know, having a brother like that is truly tremendous, and having him create you and have you feel that he molded you into the gladiator that you were in the ring is tremendous. You know, like I said, I had the opportunity to meet him, you know, and at first, because I was an engineer for the Hilton, I had to key off the elevator so the fans couldn't get to him. And I wanted to get an autograph, but I couldn't ask. And, you know, he looked at me and says, you want an autograph, don't you, kid? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, and his bodyguard asked me, well, where are you going to be at 9 o'clock? And I said, I'm going to be in the engineering office. And, you know, we got to where we needed to be, and they went about their way. And I said, oh, man, I ain't never – that was the once and only opportunity I'm going to have to get an autograph from Muhammad Ali. But I tell you what, if most people know him, Muhammad Ali was a man of his word. You know,
that's right.
9 o'clock sharp, I heard a knock on the door, and I opened it up, and it was Muhammad and two of his bodyguards, and he did the rope-a-dope, and he patted his hand on the side of my head, and he kissed me on the forehead. I didn't realize how big that man's hands were until he patted me on the side of the head. His hand actually reached from the from my chin to the back of my head. How hard was a puncher of Muhammad Ali? How hard was it for you to go those rounds with him, being that he did have that dominating factor?
Well, you know, it was like this. He gave you, which is myself, the confidence that I can go in there and compete. Now, we're just training with the big gloves, the headgear. I mean, he can only hit so hard with that apparatus on. So he gave me the confidence that I needed to go in and win a world championship. And he would always tell me, man, you holding your own with me. Those guys can't whoop you. You know, and I took that into the fight when I fought Marvin Johnson.
Yeah, that was a hell of a fight, too. You know, and I have to agree with you. You know, if you can go round by round with the best in the world, then you could conquer anybody. Barry?
Yeah. Eddie, I'm going to take you back. You know, you had mentioned that, you know, you won the 1972 Golden Gloves. You beat Patrick Maloney.
Right.
And so then you step up and you go to the Olympic trials and you end up beating Lamar Jackson in the quarters. You beat Clinton Jackson, who ends up going on to, one of the greatest amateurs, and then life
that
in prison.
Correct.
And
right.
Then life in prison for alleged kidnapping and all that. And then you lose to Jesse Valdez. What was the disappointment like to lose in the finals and then to be the alternate and kind of decline and turn pro?
I thought I beat Jesse Valdez. The very first punch I threw in the first round, Jesse came straight to me like he was a freight train. I sidestepped him and hit him right on the chin with a sizzling left hook. Down he went. You know, but my assumption of what went down in that fight was Jesse was always the favorite to, you know, for the United States. I think this was his third Olympics that he represented the United States. And here I am, an up-and-comer, newcomer. I'm just getting my foot wet, and I'm over in the finals of the trials. You know, and I beat Jesse fair and square. But, you know, hey, it is what it is. I went home that night. I took the number 2 train all the way back to Brooklyn from upstate New York. You know, and our fight was on the Wide World of Sports. They had the trials on, and Howard Cosell was calling the fight. And he gave me a vote of confidence, telling me that, great fight, kid. You did a magnificent job, you know. And like I said, the first punch I threw, down he went. And, you know, they gave it to him. But, you know, that's boxing.
Right, right. So you turn pro. You get with Jack Singer. Tell us how you ended up with Jack as your first manager.
Well, I didn't have a manager when I first turned pro, but when I started knocking guys out at the Sunnyside Garden and Fellows Forum, Jack was an avid boxing fan. You know, he had managed a couple of fighters, and he approached me and asked me that, you know, that I wanted to be your manager. You know, I said, sure. And, you know, he gave me a salary a week.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, that's what I needed. You know, my family needed. So it was good. So we had a great relationship.
You know, you were you also had some very notable guys that trained you and kind of, you know, shaped your mentality towards the boxing game. Chicky Ferrara, who was Dick Tiger's trainer. You had Slim Robinson, who was a master, you know, like he could analyze fights really well. He was a good game planner. Archie Moore, guys like that. What did those guys mean to you in shaping your, you know, the way you approach fighting?
Well, first and foremost, they were boxing. Chicky, you know, he worked with Dick Tiger. He worked with Muhammad Ali, with Angelo.
Mm-hmm.
He was always in the corner with Angelo, with Muhammad Ali. Archie, I mean, what can you say about Archie? Archie knew every trick in the book. And Slim Robinson was a master strategist. He said, this is how we're going to beat Marvin Johnson. And when he showed me the plan, I said, I got it. Everything else was easy.
Yeah. Now, you went on to, like you said, you won the world title. But I want to go back to kind of when you're up and coming. You're the number one rated contender. And this is, it's kind of, I mean, help me understand what you were thinking, because to me, it was more of a, you kind of took it as like, this is going to be easy work. This is going to be light work. And you go to Rockaway State Prison to take on James Scott, who was an inmate, and a young upstart company in HBO and the WBA, they sanctioned this. And what was going on with you at the time? To me, it seemed like a lose-lose, where even if you beat him, people are going to say, oh, he's an MA, he wasn't nothing. And then if you actually lose, you know, you lost to an MA. So take us to that fight and how weird it was, I guess, fighting in a prison.
Well, it wasn't weird to me, because the type of person I am, James was a hell of a fighter, you know.
Yep.
But I didn't know that. And I'm not saying I underestimated James to a degree where mm-hmm. I didn't train the way I should have trained, because I'm saying to myself, well, he's locked up. I mean, what could he do? He can't do nothing. He can't, you know, I mean, I got the best of both worlds coming to me. But he proved me wrong. He beat me fair and square. You know, his thing was to try to stop me, but that wasn't happening. You know, we went the full 12 rounds, great fight. We had our ups and downs, and he outpointed me. I shook his hand. You know, it's strange, because when he outpointed me, we became great friends. He would call me for advice from time to time. You know, I gave him my phone number, and he's definitely used that phone number.
Right. And that's good, though, because that's kind of he has, you know, eyes and ears out in the outside world that he didn't get to see.
Right.
And he went on, and like you said, he was actually beat Yaki Lopez and guys like that. So, I mean, it wasn't like it was a fluke thing. Like, he was the real deal. Like,
no, he beat me fair and square. That's no doubt.
Right, yeah.
No question.
Yeah, he was a legit guy. And
but he was locked up. That's the only unlegit he was. He was locked up.
Right. Now, I want to go you were supposed to be on a very highly anticipated card that, you know, you were supposed to take on, you know, your rematch with Matthew Saeed Muhammad. Ken Norton was supposed to fight Jerry Cooney. Tommy Hearns
right.
was supposed to fight Wilford Benitez. I mean, it was a loaded, loaded card. And
the
then
card
the promoter
was called, this is it. Yeah, that
yeah.
was it.
Yeah. The promoter disappears when, you know, they're looking for him for, like, embezzlement and fraud. And he ended up doing like 10 years. Did you kind of sense something was up with that card, or like did you just think everything was going as normal, or what?
Well, I was getting my biggest purse ever, $1 million, and I was looking forward to fighting Saad Muhammad because I beat him already in Philadelphia, which was his hometown. And so, well, I'm going to beat him again. This time I got myself in pretty good shape. So I'm in training for the fight, and I needed some more training expenses. I said, well, let me go to the bank and take out some money to pay my spar partners. As I'm walking to the bank, the bank president comes running out of the bank and tells me, get back in your car. Get back in your car. I'll call you later. And I'm saying, wow, okay, but I need some money. He said, look, I'll call you later. Sure enough, he called me later, and he gave me the bad news that, they froze your account. And I'm saying, well, why did they freeze my account? But he couldn't tell me. He said, I gotta talk to you later. So evidently, Harold Smith, who was the promoter at the time, embezzled a ton of money from Wells Fargo. And all that money, they had to lock it up. We couldn't touch it until I told them, well, this is what I do for a living. Whatever Harold Smith did to get that money, I was not a part of that.
Right.
I knock guys out for a living. This is what I do. This is what I'm telling the FBI guys. They came to my house. And I told them, I said, look, I'm not a bank robber. I knock guys out. That's what I do. But they let my money, they unfroze it. I didn't put up no big fight with them guys. Listen, I didn't know what Harold was doing. I didn't hang out with him all the time.
Right.
I didn't know what he did. He came to me and asked me, do I want to fight for the unification of the championship? I said, sure. Here's a guy that I already beat. And I can beat him again, no problem.
Now, you guys, back then, I guess the tough, the considered the tough circuit was like, that Philadelphia, New York, that area of guys were always kind of considered the best. And,
right, exactly.
And you took it upon yourself, you and Hagler and a few others, kind of took it upon yourselves to kind of go through that circuit and prove yourselves. And
exactly.
And you fought at, and I kind of bring this up to the other, some of the other fighters, where when you fought at MSG, when you fought at the Philadelphia Spectrum, when you fought at the Blue Horizon, there was so much history and there was so much prestige that, hey, I'm headlining this card in this arena. And now there's nothing. There's the MGM Grand or, something like that. And tell us what those buildings, fighting in some of those major arenas, meant to you then and even now.
It was a great learning experience because I'm from New York. I traveled to other guys' hometown, like Philadelphia, where I've made a great communication with the boxing fans in Philadelphia. They loved me. They adopted me. And I would go down there, and I think I've had 5 fights. I knocked out 4 guys. The only one I didn't knock out was Benny Briscoe. But that fight, we sold out the Spectrum, Benny and I. It was perfect. I love Philadelphia to this day. I love Philadelphia.
Yeah, Philadelphia is a great place. So is New York. I kind of gotta be honest. I was just in New York, and I'm kind of scared to go back to Brooklyn, Brooklyn and Queens. I was just in Jamaica and Queens for I shoot concerts also, and I helped get a few artists their first tour, and the label wanted me to go to to Jamaican Queens for their show, and I tell you what, that's a different kind of life,
shoot.
Man. I live in the Midwest.
Game, buddy.
Yeah, it's a whole new ball game.
Yep,
new
ball game.
That kind of leads me into where I want to go. Me and Barry, we always jump off each other. But what was life like for you, Eddie, as a young man growing up? What intent or what aspect drove you to the world of boxing?
Well, like I was explaining before, I don't like tagging off or passing the ball off or having a whole team. I like mano a mano, man against man. That's where I get the most out of my abilities, you know. And that's what I like, you know. We'll fight till we fall out.
That's what I love, you know. And it, you don't get that in the sport today. It's, like we were talking about earlier, it's a long-lost trait. You know, you talked about earlier before we went live, you know, you talked about the heart and the intent of creating champions. You know, when did that aspect develop in you, Eddie, that you decided it was time for you to kind of take a step away from, you know, being the focal point of the sport and creating different aspects in that avenue? Because I've had several legends on the show, and, you know, Virgil Hill comes to mind. You know, I asked him about his accolades. He said, I don't want to talk about my accolades. I had an opportunity to come back, and I decided that it was better to give back and give my knowledge to the youth and create world champions. What was it about your life that made you want to give back and instill and create world champions in the sport today?
Well, it's a long story, but I'll make it short as possible. I always made a promise to myself. You got to remember, I was a 15-round fighter. You know, they don't do that to these days. I was a 15-round fighter. So I told myself, if I ever got stopped in a fight, no matter if it was my first fight or my last fight, I got stopped in my 59th fight, which I wasn't hurt or anything like that. Larry had looked at me and asked me, was it all right? I said, I'm fine. He just said, well, I'm going to stop the fight. I asked him why. And without him returning my answer, he stopped the fight. But I didn't argue with him. I said, well, he knows best. If he feels that I can't continue, then I'll just have to call it a career. So after the fight was over, I went to the dressing room, and everybody was saying, wow, why did he stop the fight? I said, look, it is what it is, but you'll see me in my last fight. Tonight was my last fight. And I always made that promise to myself. If I would ever get stopped in a fight, that I wouldn't fight anymore.
Yeah,
you know, it was time to give that knowledge to other people, other guys that wanted to be a world champion. And that's what I've done. You know, I had the opportunity to make guys 1 in 3 times world champions. You know, I've been blessed to pass that knowledge on, and I'm getting ready to pass it on again. I got a guy that's getting ready to fight for the world title, Robert Brandt. He's from Minneapolis, Minnesota. He's fighting a guy from Japan on the 20th of October out here in Las Vegas. And if everything goes right, you know, he should win the world title.
Man, we'd love to have him on the show. You know, I think there is so much aspect of the sport, like we talked about earlier, that has declined. You know, the only way you can truly watch boxing now is if you have HBO or Showtime or you pay for a pay-per-view. And I think that's truly put a major decline in it. And then the other aspect is we were talking about, there's truly not a defined, you know, champion in the sport today. I mean, there's some great fighters, but they're not like you 15-round fighters of the past. Where do you feel that the difference was made in the sport when it made the transition from the aspect of true warriors like you to these entitled fighters that we have today.
Well, anything after 10 rounds, that's when you prove how much man you are. You know, and like I said, we were going 15 rounds. So there's no time out. I'm tired. You know, let me get a rest. No, you can't do that. You got to do what you got to do. You got to show the world what you're made of. And I showed the world what I was made of. In one fight with in New York City, I fought a guy named Mario Rosa. He knocked me down in the sixth, and I got up. He knocked me down again in the seventh. I got up, and I knocked him out in the eighth. You know, that's where that fighting heart comes in at. You know, I'm in front of my mother at the Felt Forum, and the first thing I did was looked in her eyes, and she seen her son on the floor, and I told her, don't worry about it. I'll be all right. And I got up and knocked him out. You know, that's when everybody's telling me that you're the next champion. I knew I was destined to become world champion. That was in my DNA. You know, that was in my DNA. I wanted to become, and I will become world champion. I've had a lot of people and big names in the boxing industry try to stop me from becoming a world champion. But it was ordained for me to become a world champion.
Definitely. Barry?
Yeah, Eddie, you just kind of touched on, you know, big names stopping you from trying to become a world champion. How political, I guess, is the word, because boxing's very political now. How political was it in your time?
It was, you know what, nothing changed. It's to this day. It's very political. I had to go to a fight for the title. You know, to get a title shot, I had to go to court, and I'm already number one contender. I've been number one contender for a year. And I had to go to court to fight for the title.
Jeez. Now, you went on, you know, like I said, I'm going to play a little game with you here. I'm going to give you some names, and you give me a good story about them. That you're allowed to tell, you know. And we mentioned it before we went on the air, and he was my guy back when I was growing up. He was one of my favorites, James mm-hmm. Lights Out Tony.
Good guy. Let me tell you something. He asked me to train him. I had Iran Barkley fight James Tony. James was so impressed with the tenacity that Iran put up. He figured he was going to just like walk over him. So after the fight, right after the fight, now he had Pops Miller in his corner. He called my house one day. He said, I need to talk to you. I said, all right, I'll meet you at your house. So he lives in Vegas. And he just flat out told me, I want you to train me. I said, well, you got Pop Miller. He said, no, I want you to train me. And I had, we had 12 fights together. He won 11. He lost to Montel, which he beat Montel the first fight.
Right,
but
yeah.
And that was it. So we had a good run. We had a great run.
All right. Johnny Tapia.
Listen. Here's a guy that would give you the shirt off his back, no matter if it was 15 degrees below zero. He was that type of guy. We had a good relationship together. You know, the thing about Johnny, he trusted me, and I trusted him.
Yeah, I remember Robert Garcia telling the story of him driving like 120 down Main Street in Albuquerque, but it was Johnny Tapia, so the police didn't, you know.
Yeah, don't make a difference. It was Johnny, of course.
Right, yeah. He was the man. His rival at one time, Danny Romero.
Yeah. Danny was a good guy. Danny, again, asked me. It was so ironic because here I'm in Albuquerque. I'm training Johnny. And all of a sudden, this is after they fought. He comes to Johnny's gym where I'm working with Johnny and asks me, I want you to train me. I said, wait a minute. You want me to train you? I'm training Johnny. And I sat down and talked to Johnny. Johnny said, listen, Danny's my friend. We fought. We're not going to fight no more. And that's it. If you want to train him also, no problem. So I trained Johnny, I trained Danny Romero, and another gentleman out of Albuquerque called Max Heyman. Mm-hmm. All three Albuquerqueans. I trained them at the same time at different times of the day. You know, and I thank those guys for having the confidence in me to let me be their trainer.
A past guest on our show, Mr. Paul Vaden.
Paul was a, how can I describe Paul? He was a thinking man's fighter. He had a great boxing IQ. And as you hear him speak today, you can tell that Paul never took a lot of hits because he would always move that head. He kept that jab going. He was a good combination puncher and a great individual.
Yeah, he was a super nice guy when we had him on. He was one of my favorite guys to talk to. Mr. Iran the Blade Barkley, who was also a past guest.
Listen, the meanest guy in the world. When that bell rings, you better be ready. That's all I can tell you. Listen, I've trained Iran. We won so many world titles together. You know, and I'm talking about after they said he was through. He had an eye operation. He was written off. He came to me, and he asked me, I want to make a comeback, and I want you to train me. And this is what I told him. I said, Iran, I would only train you if you listen to what I tell you to do, and I guarantee you I'll make you a three-time world champion. He couldn't believe that I was saying that because he was like, are you kidding? I can become a three-time world champion? I said, sure. And what happened? He became a three-time world champion because he listened.
Now, and see, that leads me right into what my next question for you, which you kind of touched on, was you seem to have a knack for taking guys that people think are on the downside or they don't have a chance and taking them to the top, and guys like Iran and Michael Bent when he upset Thomas Morrison.
I mean, right.
Guys like that. You know, what's your secret, man? What's your secret?
it's not basically a secret. Listen, you want to become champion? I've been there, done that. This is what I do. I create world champions. And when I tell them that, and I look into their eyes, now, if you want to become a world champion, listen to me. Remember, I've been there, done that. Let me show you how to do it. And the thing about it is they listen. Michael Bent listened. Iran, they listen. You know, and I told them, you become world champion again. They didn't believe it until I had to sit them down and I let them know, this is how we're going to do it. If you listen to me, you'll be world champion again.
Yeah.
And they listened,
let me ask you.
They became world champion.
Let me ask you one more and then I'll pass it over to Don. You had some run-ins, I believe, with Charlie Burley, who was you know, one of the all-time greats.
Exactly.
that there's really, I think there's like one film on him, and the rest is hearsay. Give me some Charlie Burley stories so I can be happy.
Okay. I met Charlie Burley at a dinner in New York. I knew about him a long time. I knew that he should have been a world champion because he beat some great guys. And I just went over there, and I let him know, listen, I'm world champion now. But I want to just shake your hand, because maybe some of that magic that you possessed can rub up on me. And he started laughing, and we took pictures together.
That's awesome.
It truly is. You know, I'm going to try something a little different here that I've never done on the show before. I'm going to see. I'm not going to say who it is, because I'm going to see if I can get him to answer his phone real quick, because I think it's a necessity. He may not answer, but if he does, we'll get him. I don't think we're going to get him.
You have reached Paul Vaden.
Oh.
Yeah, well, no, that was his answer machine. We'll get him. We'll try. I was going to try a little something special for you there, Eddie. You know, try to get Paul Vaden on here. We just had him on here a couple weeks ago.
What a guy.
Yeah.
What a guy. A great fighter.
Yeah. He was a tremendous guest on our show. You know, when you look at, and we'll move on in a second, I just want to ask this question because I think you're very profound in your thought. You know, when we had Paul on, you know, we talked about how two careers ended in the ring that night. What were your thoughts and takeaways from that fight?
When he fought and lost the title?
No, when there was a death in the ring.
Well, things happen. This is why they're trying to make boxing a better sport. You know, things happen. You know, I had a guy, James Creighton, was not known as a puncher. He was like a pity-pat guy, couldn't bust a grape. He asked me to train him for some regional title. Okay, we trained him. I said, James, listen to me, we'll win the title. But you got to listen. What did he do? He listened. He knocked the then champion out in the third round. What happened? They had to carry the guy out of the ring on a stretcher. He died that night. That's a hurting feeling, knowing that, first and foremost, I helped a guy take another life. You know, I wasn't meant to do that. You know, and it happened. It was crazy. And like I said, James wasn't known as a puncher.
You know, see, there's a couple more questions I ask you, and then I'll throw it back to Barry, and then we'll kind of wrap things up. There's something very unique about you and a handful of the aspect of the sweet science that has moved on to the better part of your life. You know, we brought up Iran Barkley earlier. What is the difference in between fighters like yourself and fighters like Iran Barkley now, who depend on others to help them, you know, make a living, succeed in life, where there's fighters like yourself that truly went on and were capable of making a meaning and creating a life after the sport. You look at, you know, the aspect that Iran is in now, and, you know, I'll be quite honest, it hurts me to see him like that, to help Milton K. Luban, you know, abusing him and you know, selling his autographs for $12 and taking him around every place he possibly can. And then what these guys do with fighters from the past, they utilize them until they don't make them anymore, and then they throw them out. What is the difference between you and that aspect of the sport? How were you able to succeed?
Well, first and foremost, you have to look into the future. The championship is not yours. You cannot box forever. Your next fight can be your last fight. That's what you got to think about going into the ring. And once you get that under control, knowing that your next fight could be your last fight, that's when you plan for your future. You know, everybody kept telling me, you know, are you should become a trainer, you're good at teaching guys. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I had a lot of opportunities. You know, I've surrounded myself with a lot of good people when I was on top, and I never, ever turned down an autograph. No matter what I was doing, I've always been, you know, acceptable to people. I never was nasty to them. Look, you want to be friends with everybody. You want to sign autographs, be friendly with everybody, be polite, courteous. I am not better than the next person. It just so happens I'm world champion, but I'm still Eddie Mustafa Muhammad from Brownsville section of Brooklyn. You know, I'm not better than you. We're all the same.
Yeah. You know, that's a tremendous, tremendous aspect of you. You know, I do want to ask you a question because you're currently training and you're making world champions. We talked a little bit earlier about a good friend of both of ours, and that being Dewey Cooper. You know, when I interviewed him, he talked about a major problem that is in the sport today. And he said that, you know, just because you got headgear on, just because you got a thicker glove on, doesn't mean that you go in the gym and you go full bore. He said, you know, in his thoughts and his aspects, that you look at training as a tool, but you got to be smart in your training. Don't go in the gym and beat the hell out of each other. You know, that should be saved for the fight, or
exactly,
you know, when you get closer to the fight. What are your thoughts in that aspect of training? Do you think that if a lot of boxers, you know, kind of pulled it back from 90% to 70% and saved most of themselves for fight night, do you think that there would be a lot less injuries or certain brain damage that won't be reflected in the later years of their life if they train smarter?
Well, first and foremost, the brain was not meant to be shaken. It's not a James Bond martini, shaken and stirred. You understand what I'm saying? The brain sits in a gel of liquid in your head. It's not meant to be rattled and shaken, because that's where you got the trauma cause to get involved in. You can't be shaking the brain up. You know, all of a sudden now you're getting punches and you're working hard in the gym. I don't care how big the gloves is, what type of headgear you got on, you're still shaking that brain. The brain was not made to be shaken.
Yeah, it truly wasn't. You know, Eddie, I got one more question, then I'm going to pass it to Barry. You had a long and illustrious career at lightweight and cruiserweight. You fought some of the most tremendous fighters that ever stepped in the ring or even existed in the sport. If you had to take one fight, and champ, I know that's hard to do, but if you had to take one fight, as your most memorable fight, what fight would that be?
Well, it's the fight I had with Michael Spinks when he took the title from me. I said to myself, going in, I know what I went through, first and foremost, to make the weight. And when I made the weight, I told myself, now you're not going to beat me. I said, I guarantee you. I said, we're going to go 15 rounds. I said, it's going to be one hell of a fight, and you're going to remember me. And sure enough, I saw Michael 2 weeks ago. And he always talk about the fight. I remember you. You know, we always talk about it. But like I said, and like you seen the fight. I beat Michael. But, I mean, listen, it's out of my hands. You know, he was an Olympic gold medalist. I was from the hood. You know what I'm saying? So I did what I had to do. But I told myself and I told everybody that would listen, we're going 15 rounds, and it's going to be a tough 15 rounds. And it was.
I lied. I'm going to ask you one more question, because I'm good friends with Leon Spinks. And
I'm good friends with Leon also.
Yeah. Well, then you know you don't take him drinking, man.
know, the, not at all.
Well, you know, most people, they think it's great. Well, man, that's Leon Spinks. And you know, Leon and that, you know, laugh. And
he
tells a few stories. But the man drinks Cavassier, and he only drinks doubles. So you're looking at $18 a pop. So if you sit down for 2 hours with him, you're going to be a couple hundred bucks light.
The game is over.
You know, yeah. Oh, I used to try to pass him off. I'd see a rich buddy walk in. I'd be like, hey, man, you ever met Leon Spinks, bro? And I'd say, oh, well, I got to get. You know, what's it like? Because, you know, the brotherhood, you know, I shot boxing, and it's been brought up on the show several times. You know, you look at MMA, and there truly isn't a brotherhood. But you look at the sport of boxing, and the brotherhood was truly a unique, I wouldn't even call it a circle, I would call it a dot. Would right. you say that the brotherhood in boxing is truly what molded you into the man you are today, being that it was such a small aspect of people that correlated themselves with each other?
Well, you got to remember this here and think about this. We go in the ring to beat each other's brains out. But after that last and final bell, what do? We go over to each other's corner and hug. So that tells you the whole story right there. It tells you the whole story. You know, you go after you sit there trying to beat my brains out, or I try to beat your brains out, we go and hug each other.
Yeah. You know, well, see, the reason
Marvin
I asked
Johnson,
that question. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
No, go ahead, sir.
Marvin Johnson was a roommate of mine on the 72 Olympic team. He was the guy sleeping in the next bed from me. I never knew that I was going to be fighting this guy for a world title. And after we fought, this is about maybe a year after we fought, I saw Marvin one day at a dinner, and he walked up to me and told me, he said, man, you really hurt me. He said, you really hurt me. You know, and I told him, said, Marvin, you know, this is what people pay to see us do. But it is what it is. You know, you were trying to hurt me, but I wouldn't let you do that.
Yeah. Well, see, the reason I asked was because, you know, I got my start in boxing, and then I transitioned into the sport of mixed martial arts and mm-hmm. kickboxing and different aspects. But then when I tried to make my return to boxing, I was shunned. And, you know, I try, you know, when I talked to Barry about it, because me and Barry started doing a show about 7-8 years ago called Beyond the Ropes, you know, and I told Barry, you know, it's really hard once you leave boxing to get back into that inner dot, that brotherhood. Why do you think it's so, you know, such an aspect like that? It took me years to get back into that circle of boxers. Why do you think that aspect portrays once you leave the sport?
Boxing changes every second. Every second. One day, you have a guy that's heavyweight champion. A month from now, 2 months from now, he's not heavyweight champion. Now, if you've been in there promoting fights, you're going to miss out on a whole lot of stuff. You won't even know who the flyweight champion is. When you were up on boxing, when you were in boxing, you were on top of your game. Now, you got to like, wow, who's the champion now? We got so many champions. You know, it's hard to catch up. It's hard to get that brotherhood. You, listen, you could never retire from boxing. You know, if I retire from boxing, I don't know what I'd do with myself. You know, it's just a hard situation.
Most definitely. Barry?
Yeah, Eddie, unlike Don, I kind of like the Jim War story. And I've talked to a lot of guys, and, you know, off the record and all that stuff, that, you know, things kind of get heated sometimes in the gym. And it's like, hey,
right.
Let's throw down. And the Mayweather gym, they have what they call, like, the doghouse rule. You know, I mean, you
exactly.
see the videos and stuff where there's no
witness.
Time.
I'm there every day. I'm there
right.
every
there's
day.
No, there's no time. There's it's just
right.
we fight until somebody quits. What
Listen,
is
me and Ali?
What is
at one time when he pulled the plug out of the wall, and
yeah.
we fought for about maybe about an hour.
Jesus. And now, tell me, if you can, the best fight you've seen in the gym.
Well, I wouldn't let it go that far because cooler heads have to prevail. Somebody can really get hurt.
Right.
So I wouldn't let it go. If I see it getting out of hand, I'm going to jump in, and I'm going to stop the fight.
Yeah.
I don't care.
I'm talking about not like out for blood, but, you know, but I'm saying like two top guys, like Floyd Jr. and Paul Spadafora had a infamous sparring session.
Yes,
you know,
I wasn't at that melee. And at that time, Floyd didn't have his gym.
Right,
we were
right,
at Richard
absolutely.
Steele's gym.
Right. And that's the thing that people kind of forget about Floyd, to me, is Floyd's a dog. If you really, really want to get it on, he'll get it on with
you. Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
And my thing was, and, you know, when he fought Conor McGregor, and the public, and Floyd said, well, let's fight an 8-ounce, you know, because they were going to fight in 10. And he said, well, let's fight an 8. And everybody's like, oh, my God, what an advantage. And I was like, you morons, Floyd's fought 90% of his career in 8-ounce gloves. Shut up.
That's right.
I'm like, he just tricked this man into agreeing to something, making him think he's going to do good.
You know, I knew exactly what Floyd was thinking about when he took Conor McGregor deep. He took him into deep water, then he drowned him. That's all that was. If you really look at it, Floyd put the pressure on him behind a jab, and then he started going to the body, and then that was it. Conor McGregor is not a boxer. He's a martial artist. There's two different situations.
Yeah, absolutely. And the best part for me was the video where they, you know, they're in the corner and, like, they're, you know, the ring. And Floyd is going, not yet. Nope, not yet. And then the fourth round, you see, pass him on the head, and he's like, now it's time. And then he just starts whooping, you know, beating him for fun.
He used psychological warfare on that guy. It was those who know boxing knew when the bell rang for the first round, knew what Floyd was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, Conor McGregor never went 12 rounds. Come on, man, this is crazy. All you got to do is hands up high. You apply a little jab and body shots. You wear him out. He's not used to getting hit to the body.
Yeah,
that's
all. All my friends that actually gamble, they called me about that fight. I said, bet everything you own, bet the farm on Floyd.
That's right.
I said he's not losing. But no, I just thought that was a kind of the psychological warfare, which Muhammad Ali made famous,
exactly.
To kind of get into his opponent's heads.
Right.
What kind of mentality do you kind of, because as, when the fight's announced, that's actually, to me, in my opinion, when the fight starts. And I think when you watch Floyd, who's a master at this sport, go into fight mode, and he starts selling the fight, and then kind of, and you've been through the same thing, take us into, like, your mental mind state as the fight gets closer, how you change mentally to prepare for a 15-round battle.
Well, the thing about it is, going in the door, you know that I'm going 15 rounds, I'm going to get into the best condition that I can possibly get my body into. I'm going to do my running, I'm going to do my boxing, and I'm going to stay focused on the job at hand. And that's what I do. And once that 8 weeks is complete, now I'm going to war.
Now, did you have any set, like, rituals that you kind of went through? Like, you know, were you like, you got to stay away from me from this, heading to the fight?
No.
Like, or you just were calm and relaxed and it was just another day at the office?
That's like you just said, it was another day at the office, because for the simple reason, from the first and second round, I know how the fight's going to end. If I got a guy that's going to press me and throw punches, I got you. I'm going to knock you out. That's the bottom line. If I got to go look for you, that's a whole entirely different story. You know, the majority of the guys, they figure, well, we're going to go to him and see what he brings to the table. Well, I bring to the table the full course meal. You know, and then I hit you on the chin, and you're going. Just like Jerry Martin. When I fought Jerry Martin, you got to remember, he just beat the legendary James Scott, who beat me.
Yeah.
So Bob Arum said, listen, you know, you got to fight Jerry Martin because the WBA made him number one. I said, well, when I knock him out, I'll see what the WBA going to say then. And that's what I did. I knocked him out.
Now, you know, you've mentioned you're from Brownsville. You're very proud of it. There's a couple other names, you know, Riddick Big Daddy Bo and Zab. You know, Zab's from there. There's a lot of talent, crazy talent that has came out of Brownsville.
Exactly. Listen, we have all types of athletes. Willie Randolph, the New York Yankees, he grew up right across the street from me. World Be Free, basketball player. He grew
from
up
the
right
Cavs,
across
the Cleveland Cavs.
Exactly. All these guys, they grew up across the street from each other. But one thing about them, they supported me and I supported them. When they had a basketball game or a baseball game, I was always there to support. We always called Willie Randolph, his name was Mickey. We always called him Mickey. But we supported all our athletes. Otis Wilson, you know, the Chicago Bears, we supported him. We used to fly to Chicago, spend the night at Otis's house a night before the game. To show him that, hey, man, I'm doing my sport. You supported me. I have to support you. And that's what we did.
Now, you know, we're talking about the guys that made it. Who was the best athlete from your neighborhood that didn't make it?
Fly Williams. I don't know if you ever heard of Fly Williams. James Fly Williams. He was a great basketball player. I seen him. He was playing in the old ABA.
Mm-hmm.
And I seen him dunk on Julius Erving. It was on TV. Should have never did that. Yep. When
he got blackballed or what?
No, he got, I think Julius scored about 50 points on him. And on TV, you don't dunk on Julius. You're crazy. But he dunked on him. That was his bravado. He dunked on Julius. You know, there was a lot of guys from our neighborhood that, you know, made professional basketball teams, baseball teams. I mean, it was crazy. Ron Hagler, you know, he was a great basketball player. But you don't hear enough about those guys, you know.
Right. And that's kind of why I wanted to ask you that. So they could, you know, kind of get a shout out if they ever heard it or whatever. That, you know, you never forgot the guys from your neighborhood. And and for that, you know, that kind of shows your character and the man that you are. I had a blast interviewing you tonight. It was awesome. I look forward to having you on again in the future. If you're willing, I appreciate
any
your time.
Anytime.
I'm going to hand it to Don. Like I said, hopefully you enjoyed the interview tonight, and it was definitely my pleasure.
I enjoyed it.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it, champ. We enjoyed having you. You know, I think giving, you know, champions from the past an opportunity to come on and share little tidbits and stories of their life is a necessity, you know, because this sport is something that we truly grew up on, something that we truly love, and you guys are the creators of it. You know, I think there's only one other interview that I really liked more than this one, and I think you could kind of fill this in, you know, for me after I state it. You know, we interviewed a gentleman by the name of Joey Giambra Sr., the uncrowned champion, fought from 1949 to 1963. And on the show, he said that he never got a title because the mob wanted him to take a fall. And he refused to take a fall, therefore they never gave him a title shot. How much of that aspect of the sport was perplexed into your day?
Well, I mean, that day, the mob was done. It was done as far as mixing mob associates with boxing. There's remnants of it, but it's not the remnants of years gone by. There's not one guy like Blinky Palermo, Frankie Carbo. Those guys are not non-existent, but there's still some shenanigans going on at boxing. You know, not the cheat type, whereas this guy's taking a dive here. Like, I saw one guy that's literally walked out of the ring before the bell rang. You know, he was, they announced him, and he walked out of the ring. He was ready to fight.
Yeah, I saw that.
Wow, that's really a mob story. What a mob.
You know, I still don't, you know, I... From my understanding, it was a money situation. I don't tend to believe that story. You know, I have a feeling he got into the ring and he looked
at
his opponent.
Right.
Yeah, said, I don't want no part
of
this.
That was it. Right.
You know, 'cause that man was a beast. You know,
he was a big dude.
Yeah, he was. He was a big, scary dude. I'd have walked away, too. I ain't going to lie. I would have walked away, too.
That was crazy.
You know, champ, it was a tremendous opportunity for us to have you here on the show. I know you're training champions, and I know you're creating greatness in the sport, you know, still today. Now, if people wanted to reach out to you and get training under you or just get advice from you, how would they be able to do that?
Well, they can listen. I'm never afraid to give my number to anyone. You know, if you want to become a world champion, this is how we do it. You know, I'll give my number out. I'll give it out right now. Area code 702-349-5464. Call me anytime and let me know what your situation is. And if you think that you have what it takes to become a world champion, let's go.
Man, I love that. You know, I got one more question and I'm going to let you go. You know, there's been a whole new onslaught of really tremendous trainers out there, one being Dewey Cooper. You know, one, you know, also is yourself. You know, what do you see in trainers like Dewey Cooper and what do you feel they're doing for the sport?
Well, I see Dewey just about every day. And Dewey is the type of guy that loves the sport, and he's not going to let you cheat yourself by not getting in top condition, mentally and physically. You know, he's not going to let you beat yourself. If anybody beats one of Dewey's guys, he was just a better guy. But Dewey has his guys in top condition mentally and physically. Dewey is a hell of a trainer.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I love the man. You know, champ, I'm going to hand the microphone over to you. If there's anything else you'd like to add to the program, any social media sites, any friends or family, the floor is yours, champ.
Well, I'm just, listen, if you guys want to get in touch with me, I'm always at Floyd's gym. You know, I'm always at Floyd's gym. Just walk down the block, you hear a whole lot of noise. That's the gym. You know, so just come in and hang out.
Yeah, actually, Floyd Sr. was supposed to come on the show, and the way things got changed around, I think it's going to end up being next week that comes to apparition. You know, champ, I hope you like the show. I hope you like what we're doing to continue. You know, we just want to give you guys a voice because I think it's, you know, champions like you, fighters like you that have truly given the sport the basis on which it's founded on, and I'm forever indebted for you to come on the show and share who you are with my listeners.
And it was,
on that note,
it
champ,
was an honor and a pleasure.
Much.
An honor and a pleasure for me to grace your show. You know, so that works both ways. Listen, we can't do it without you guys giving us a plug, and I appreciate that.
Well, we're truly humbled. Thank you so much, champ. And until next time, we're going to get you back on again, man. You know what? I'll tell you what. I'll even extend the offer. The young gentleman that you got getting ready to fight in Vegas, if you'd like to have him on the show, me and Barry would be more than willing to have him on here and give him a voice.
Okay, that sounds great. I still got your number, and we'll contact you right after we win the title. October 20th in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Until then, you have a tremendous evening, champ. Thank you for blessing my listeners and my show.
You're very welcome.
Have a good night, sir. Thank you.
God bless you. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Eddie Mustafa Muhammad. You know, Barry, I got to tell you, I was a little stymied on this interview because I don't think we've ever had a champion so forthwith about everything.
Yeah, Eddie's an open book. He tells it like he sees it, and you know, you can't fault the man for that. I mean, he's obviously had success, you know what I mean? So if you're successful, I mean, it's hard to argue with success.
Yeah, you know, and one thing I think I took away from tonight's show is that, you know, when he said that I wasn't hurt, but, whenever I got stopped, I told myself I was going to walk away from the sport. Do you think that if there was a lot of fighters out there that are in boxing that truly realized after 59 fights that when they came to that conclusion and walked away, do you think that there would still be, you know, an aspect, you know, like he is? You know, Eddie is truly on point, but I think what he took away from that, he's now instilling in younger boxers and creating an older aspect of the sport, but in a newer generation. Do you think the sport would be a much better place if a lot of the older legends had done that?
It differs because, you know, it's like Magic Johnson when he coached the Lakers. Magic was a great player, but he's not a great coach. You know what I mean? Not every great fighter can be a great coach or trainer. I just think it takes certain characteristics. And Eddie Mustafa Muhammad has those characteristics, which translated easily into him being a great trainer. As like Roger Mayweather, as Floyd Sr., you know, guys like that. That, you know, I'm just saying that, you know, the gym there. Those guys know what's going on. I mean, they're with it. Teddy Atlas, so just, you know, Freddie Roach. Guys that have certain characteristics that they can easily transition into training other fighters. It's not for everyone, and I think it's the people that you surround yourself with that teach you the sport that gives you those certain characteristics.
Yeah. You know, I got to agree with you. And, you know, I think after tonight's show, I think the opportunities that are going to come from this interview are more profound. Eddie doesn't give very many interviews. I was honored and humbled that he picked up the phone and called me. And, you know, I'm blessed in life in that aspect, being able to correlate myself, like we were talking about on the show. You know, once I left the sport, it was kind of hard for me to work my way back in. And you know as well as I do, it's taken me, what, 7-8 years to do so? You know, it's a non-forgiving sport. They just don't let you back in. I mean, you kind of got to earn that respect all over again. But I think with Eddie giving us his approval, I think a little bit more and more each time we make that step closer and closer to bringing on, you know, all aspects of the sport that we're looking for. You know, Barry, It truly is an honor. I mean, I think he stymied even Eddie Mustafa Muhammad tonight with knowing some of the knowledge that you do. You know, I'm going to bust your chops while we're on the air before we get off here real quick. You know, Barry always says that I carry him through the show, and that's absolute bullshit. You know, Barry is a walking encyclopedia when it comes to boxing. If you couldn't catch that in tonight's episode, then I don't know what to tell you. But, Barry, it truly is an honor to have someone like you on this show, because I don't think it's an aspect that anybody else could bring. You know, you truly know stories that aren't out there, and you stymie the fighters when you bring these stories up. And it just shows how much love you truly have for the sweet science and the sport in general. You know, my friend, you truly are an encyclopedia, and I'm honored to do a show with you. Each and every time we do one, you blow me away with the knowledge and the ability that you have to just pull things out of your hat. And not very many people can do that. So you truly do deserve the credit. You do carry me each and every time on a boxing show. You know, we correlate together good because we're friends in real life, but you truly are a great aspect of the show that can't be replaced, my friend.
Oh, Don, a tear strolled down my cheek listening to that.
It should have, damn it.
Yeah. Well, did you pre-write that? No, I appreciate it, man. And like I said, I always mess with you and ask you if you're going to be able to carry me this week. But, you know, like I said, it's something that I enjoy doing, something that I love. So it's, you know, it's just a passion. And like I said, once you fall in love with something, you never really fall out of love with it. As is the case with, you know, Eddie, our guest tonight. He, you know, like you said, if he ever retired, he don't know what he'd do. I mean, this is what he loved. This is what he's also, you know, he's married to the game. That's as they say, he's married to the game, and you have to respect that. And, you know, it's always a pleasure to do a show with you. And I look forward to every Thursday, man, to having new guests on and getting the guys on so they can, you know, tell us the stories and we can find out what was actually happening in their minds when the fights were taking place.
Yeah. You know, one thing before I let you go here, you know, I did like how you did that. You know, you said, I'm going to play a game with you here. I'm going to say a name and you tell me a little bit of a story. You know, that right there has a unique aspect. You know, I tried to call Paul Vaden while we were live on the air. I wish you could have got through. It'd have been a tremendous moment, you know, to hear two brothers talk, you know. But we'll correlate things like that in the future. You know, I think that's a much-needed aspect to give these guys not just a voice but an opportunity to share a few moments with each other live while we're on the air. With that being said, I want to thank Finished MMA, Juan Martinez. I want to thank Ed Cutman for Hire with Jacob Stitch Duran and Juan Ramirez. I want to thank the 86ers.net with Alfred and Freddie and Bite Me Mouth Guards with Joe Rice. You know, I got four tremendous sponsors that truly back me each and every step of the way. And you look at the aspects of what they are in the sport, and they're not just MMA, they're boxing. They're some legends. And to have those four names on my back and on my show truly has blessed me in life. You know, I get hit by sponsors every day, and I apologize that I refuse to bring anybody on. But, you know, when you got one team, you got one dream, and they allow me to share my voice the way it should be told and the way the listeners are loving. I want to thank the listeners because the last show we did hit 313,000 live listens, which is kind of crazy because we started out organically and it kind of pushed us into the top 10 bracket. Figuratively, by the demographic charts, we're number 7 in talk radio, which is a tremendous aspect, you know, considering we did come from an organic platform. But you know what? We're the fighter's voice. We give the fighters a voice, the one and only true voice. You know, you see what you see on TV, you hear what you hear on the internet, but unless you hear it out their mouth, it's truly not their voice, and that's what we give them. On that note, thank you so much, Barry. If there's anything else you'd like to add before we get out of here, the floor is yours, brother.
Yeah, no, like I said, I just like to thank the listeners, the people that actually take the time to tune in and, you know, hear the fighters, not us back and forth, to actually hear the fighters and their story. I appreciate that. And the sponsors that hit Don up, you just hit me up and I'll take you. I don't mind.
Right, King Barry.
Right.
Just search out King Barry. You know, I'm still pissed off about that, bro. Before I let you go, I'm still pissed off about that. How is James Tony, James Lightell Tony, going to name me Dandy Don and give me that name for over 15 years and come on the show with you and your King Barry? Ain't that some bullshit?
Brother, he recognizes talent. That's all you can say.
Oh, here we go. I knew it was going to come out. On that note, man, thank you, Barry. I appreciate it. You know what? We're going to take this out with a little bit of, hell, I don't know. You know what? Let's go ghetto with some rap champion. On that note, everybody have a blessed evening. Thank you, and God bless. Appreciate you, my brother, Barry. We're out of here.
Rhythm, it's all mine. Bumping my Alpine, sneaking the baseline. Applauses when no positives.